Well, when I found out I was the chair this week, my first thought, who am I going to get to talk for today? Well, my mind went to Caroline, this girl who we went, a lot of us went down to have her celebrate her 6th birthday, I think it was, a few months ago. And so before, when I tried to get her to come, they were going to be out of town. So I called her and asked her to come, and I'm talking to her husband, and he said, "You should go there." I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll be there." Yesterday, her husband called me and told me they had a death they needed to, service they needed to attend today, and she would be unable to come, but he was sending us a replacement. And I said, "Good. Now I have my problem, my rock thing. I wish I had his chair. Who will get me on his Friday?" And when he told me that, everything lit up and I was very well pleased. I didn't know he was going to send me this good looking man down here. Somebody I don't know anything at all about. I've never seen him before in my life, to my knowledge. I might have seen him when I was drunk. Anyway, I've never seen him before in my life. I hear that he's got something good to tell us, and I'm going to let him explain himself and talk about himself. Help me welcome him. Come on, Jim. First started going there in assembly in Montgomery. There were 5 people active in that assembly named Jim. And I began to think everybody east of the Mississippi named Jim had a problem. There comes another one. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Lou. And thank y'all for having me here. I'm sure you'd rather have Carolyn here. She is much better to look at, I guarantee you. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers. My sobriety date's February 18, 2002, and I'm a member of the Central Orlando Group in Orlando, Florida. Living in Georgia, going to Eufaula AA meetings, and I'm in Phoenix City, Alabama on a Saturday morning. I do not know where my God's got me going next, but it's usually somewhere it's got something to do with recovery, and I'm really glad to be here. The book says, you know, I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, generally. I will tell you that some of my story, because of the time I grew up, involves outside influence. But I'm a strong proponent of the Alcoholics Anonymous program, the traditions, and the singleness of purpose. And no matter what, alcohol was the first thing I ever took. Alcohol was there the whole time I took anything else, and alcohol was there at the end. And so I'm a real alcoholic, as described in the book. And how they wrote a story about a guy named Jim, I don't know, but they must have known I was coming. All of us east of the Mississippi named Jim were coming, I think, too. I was the 5th of 6 children in a military family. My father was an Air Force hero. He didn't like me to call him that, but he was. And we moved around quite a bit. Every couple of years we were picking up and moving, and until I was 13, we never stayed anywhere longer than a couple of years, except one time we lived for 3.5 years in Japan. Moving around and all the other things didn't make me an alcoholic. My parents were not alcoholics at all. They might have had a cocktail once a month when they had a little gathering of the base people over to the house, but neither one of them were alcoholics, and they didn't talk about alcoholics. Both my grandfathers died from the disease of alcoholism, but we didn't talk about it in my family. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous until I walked into my first meeting, and that was in 1998. And it took a little while because I was different. I wasn't like everybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I struggled for a few years. And I don't recommend that to anybody who's new. I recommend getting into the book right away and doing exactly what it says. We moved to a place in Tacoma, Washington, and I was 10 years old. And when I did my inventory, one of the things that my sponsor told me is that I got to go back all through my life and write down everything, not just from when I was drinking. And so I realized that when I wrote down stuff from when I was 10, I'd already been a liar, a cheater, and a thief before I ever took a drink of alcohol. Three of us were coming home from school. We cut through a little field. We caught a little field mouse, and it bit one of my friends. And he put it in his lunch pail, and he took it home with him. And he told his mom, and his mom called my mom, and my mom came rushing in and said, "Did you get bit by that mouse too?" And I said, "Yes, I did. I thought I wouldn't have to go to school for a while if I got bit by a mouse." And that wasn't the situation. What I got was rabies shots. And that wasn't very fun. Those were pretty painful, I'll have you know. And that was simply because I was just a liar. You know, I didn't like school at all, and I was already well into lying. We moved to Duluth, Minnesota the next year. And if you ever have a chance to visit Duluth, Minnesota, don't. That place is the coldest place on the earth, I'm telling you, right on Lake Superior. And we lived there for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. I was 11 years old. My oldest sister got married. And at the reception, the colonel said that everybody could take a sip of champagne to celebrate. And so my older brother and my three older sisters and I got a little glass, and we toasted my sister. And they sipped theirs. And I didn't. I just drank mine right down. And something happened. A lot of people call it the magic moment or that special time. I call it the Moors, because what it did for me, it doesn't do for normal people. I know I'm an abnormal drinker today, but it made me want more from the very start. And so I slipped back by that champagne fountain, and I got five or six more, and then I was hammered. And a little 11-year-old boy spinning around, it put me in bed. I came to the next morning, covered in vomit. I had peed on myself, and I had a headache that I describe as a little man in my head with a sledgehammer and an anvil just pounding away. And normal people would say, "I don't ever want to do that again." And I said, "I can't wait to get that feeling again." And I'm 11 years old. A couple of years later, we moved to Orlando, Florida. I was in heaven. There was no more snow. You know, we used to have to shovel the snow for my dad every day. And I got with a group of guys that were about 5 years older than me, and they liked to do what I like to do. They liked to get totally wasted, hammered, as I called it. And so we proceeded to every chance we get to get alcohol, and like I said, other substances, because it was in the late 60s. I didn't want to work, I didn't want to go to school, and so I became a burglar. And the five of us, and then wound up being about 10 of us, we'd get really drunk at night. When my parents went to bed, I'd slip out of the house, I'd get really drunk with my friends, and we'd burglarize homes all over Central Florida. Now, this is back in the day when people used to leave their doors unlocked and the keys in their car. And all we were looking for is people's alcohol. You know, we weren't trying to get their silverware, their jewelry. I wasn't that smart. I wasn't even smart enough to wear a pair of gloves. And I continued to get arrested over and over and over and get taken to the juvenile home, either for truancy because I wouldn't go to school or because they got my fingerprints off of burglary. And that just continued for a couple of years, where I'd get out for a little while, I'd go back, start burglarizing homes, I'd get caught, and I'd be back in the juvenile home. Now, you get locked up in the juvenile home, you get out twice a day, once to go eat and once to go to school. I don't like school. Now I'm being locked up and having to go to school. You know, somewhere along the line, you would think I would have got it. I didn't. When I turned 16, I picked up a gun, and I started armed robberies. And I did that for the next couple of years. I was arrested and put in county jails multiple times, and I was always bailed out. My parents were really good to me, and I don't call them enablers. They just didn't know any different. Nobody ever talked about a rehab or, you know, alcoholism or anything like that. I was a criminal, and so I should be locked up. And that's exactly what was happening. When I was 17, I was arrested for a whole boatload of felonies, and this time my parents weren't going to get me out. And I wrote my dad a letter. He was back from TDY somewhere, and I wrote him a four-page letter. And I call it the alcoholic letter. You know, it's, "Dad, if you get me out of this, I promise I will never do this again. I promise, you know, I will never do this again." And I meant every word of it. I meant every word of it. And after about 3 months, he finally posted the bail. He had to borrow some money from my grandmother, who had money set aside for my college education, which wound up going to a bunch of attorneys. So I never made it to college. I never made it to high school even. And he posted the bail. And like I said, I meant every word of "I'll never do this again." And my parents went to sleep that night. I broke into his gun cabinet. I stole the .45 automatic he carried through three wars. I went over the back wall of our house, and I took off to California, driving through southeast United States, doing armed robberies all the way to California. When I got to California, I had serum hepatitis, and I got that from dirty needles. Drinking out of control, and I'm 18 years old. I get admitted to a military installation in California, in Santa Rafael, California. I remember Hamilton Air Force Base, because they still had a military dependent ID card, and the guys I was running with didn't like the color I was turning. I was turning orange. And so they kind of kicked me out of the car at the emergency room. They rushed me into isolation, and I was there for about 3 months, almost dead. I almost died from hepatitis at that time. I got out of there. They got me well enough that I could be released. Now, I've got a wanted poster at the Navy base in Orlando, but they don't communicate across country back then. You know, we're talking about the early 70s. And so I'm in a military hospital getting well. I get out of there. We do a run up towards Minnesota. I'm doing the same thing all over again. I'm not getting caught. I got arrested once in Minneapolis, and the charges were dropped, and I immediately got out of that town, and I flew back to Orlando. Now, when I got back to Orlando, I came back to sneak in to go to a party. A friend of mine was having a party, and so I flew back. I snuck in. Unfortunately, the police departments in all of Central Florida had been looking for me for about a year, and they had an informant, and they knew I was going to be at that party, and they did a major raid at that party. And something happened. I know now the hand of God was with me throughout my entire life. I did not have a religious upbringing. We did not go to church very often. Maybe Christmas, maybe Easter, the colonel and my mother would dress us up and show us off. But that was the only time. So I had no clue about religion or Bible or Buddha or any of that stuff. And I know today that the hand of God was there, because as they raided the house, I just traded some outside influences for a .38, and I thought we were being ripped off. I'd been through a lot of armed robberies on my part, and I thought we were having a drug rip off. And there's a guy at the bottom of the stairs pointing a gun at me, and I'm pointing my gun at him, telling him to drop it. And it seemed like it was like 5 minutes, because I had done some animal tranquilizers and drank heavily, so I was drunk and crazy. And the guy at the bottom of the stairs didn't shoot me. And eventually I dropped my gun. Now, that man retired as the chief of police of the Maitland Police Department. And when I went to make amends to him, I asked him, "Why didn't you shoot me?" You know? And he said, "I don't know, but I remember the case. And I don't know why I didn't shoot you." And that's why I say it was the hand of God then. I was arrested. I was taken back to jail. I'm 18 years old. I go before a judge. I have hepatitis again. I'm in an isolation cell. And the judge doesn't think I have very many redeeming qualities, so he sentenced me to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida. That's a maximum security facility, and I'm 18 years old, and I'm dying. And I have so much fear running through me, it's unbelievable. And the only book in that isolation cell was the Bible. And I told you, I don't have any religious upbringing. I never read the Bible. But I grabbed a hold of that book, and I just started praying, saying, "Please, God, don't let this happen. Please, God, don't let this happen. And when they came to get me, I thought they were getting me to transfer me up to the state penitentiary, and they took me back before the judge, and he says, I've reconsidered. I'm going to give you 18 months on a chain gang. And back then, if you've seen the movie Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman, that's what a chain gang was. I mean, you see prisoners now on the highway with weed eaters and blowers and, you know, I'm sorry, that's not what we did. We had a sickle and a blade, and we were in a ditch from sun up to sundown 6 days a week. And, you know, for the first month, I'm coming out of isolation, hepatitis, I fell out every day. And back then, they didn't call the ambulance to take you to the hospital. They just picked you up, put you under the truck. And, you know, at the end of the day, you got in the truck and you went back to camp. Well, I wasn't totally stupid. I was pretty stupid, but not totally. I could see the progression of if you do good and the boss likes you, you can get out of the ditch and you can sharpen the blades. You don't have to be in the ditch. But I saw the progression further than that. I saw the progression of there's 150 prisoners getting fed three meals a day plus the guards. And if I can get inside that building and I can convince them that I'm being reformed, I can get inside that kitchen. And if I can get inside that kitchen, there's enough ingredients. When you're feeding that many people three meals a day, I had already known how to make something called buck. And it's alcohol-based. It's kind of funny, I say this now, that the first couple times I spoke, I went through details on the ingredients, on how to make it, and my sponsor finally said, stop doing that. And he was right. Needless to say, I knew how to make it. I eventually got into the kitchen, and I started making it. And for filler, and this is why, in the doctor's opinion, it really nails me right on the head. For filler, we use those gray rotten grapefruit that sit on the ground and turn powdery and get real nasty. That was what we put in there for the filler. And then we drained it through a sock. I always say, I don't know if it was a clean or a dirty sock. It really didn't matter. All that mattered is I got the effect produced by alcohol. And I got out of there. I did my parole and probation afterwards, moved to a little town in Mississippi, and met my future ex-wife. She wasn't my ex-wife then. But I can tell you, she stayed with me for 21 years. And I drank alcoholically for those 21 years. And God bless her, because had it not been for something that happened and her doing something about it by talking to my parents, I wouldn't be here today. I'd be dead, and I know that for a fact. We had a lot of really good years, I'm sure. And when we were married 17 years, she was able to carry a baby to full term, almost full term, 8 months. We lost three before then. And I've got a son who's almost 19 years old. His name's Forrest. And at the time, we weren't really getting along all that well. Now, I got to tell you, I got up every morning and went to work. I didn't have the shakes in the morning. I didn't drink in the morning. When I reconciled with my father at the age of 26, I got in the real estate business with him. And somehow or another, all those felonies disappeared from my record. So I was able to have an escrow account. I was able to do things. And I did pretty well in real estate. My ex-wife didn't have to work. And then we married 17 years. We have this little boy. We can't agree on a first name. So we go see the movie Forrest Gump. And we walk out of that movie and we both think, you know, what a great name for a kid, Forrest, you know, if it's a boy. Because we never got a sonogram. We didn't know if it was going to be a boy or a girl, so we already had the girl's name picked out. You got to see that movie about two or three times before you realize who Forrest Gump is named after. You know, his great-great-grandfather was the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And my son lives in Columbus, Mississippi, which is, you know... But she wanted to name him Austin, and my last name is Power, so I'm really glad that didn't happen. I wanted to name him Seamus, but she wasn't having that either. So, my son has been to thousands of AA meetings. Open meetings, he sits in the room with me. Closed meetings, he sits either in a coffee bar or in another room. Every group I've ever been to has a place that a child could sit. And when I started going to meetings, finally, every time I had him, he would be with me at meetings. And he's 19 years old. He doesn't drink. He doesn't do drugs. He's a great kid. And a couple of months ago, he called me while he was doing a 12-step call. Cool stuff. My drinking had progressed, like it says in the book, it had progressed to a very serious stage. And a very serious stage I was having back trouble. My middle sister had multiple myeloma, which is a bone marrow disease, and she was dying from that. And she had some back pain pills, and I complained about my back hurting. She said, "Well, you want some of these pills?" And I said, "Yeah, yes, I do." And so I took some of those, and I drank heavily one night. And sometime about 2 o'clock in the morning, my bladder said to get up, and my brain didn't hear it because it was passed out. And I woke up to this woman screaming and yelling at me, "You're peeing all over me, you're peeing all over me." And that's where I had gone. I had lost control of my bodily functions. But I'm not an alcoholic. Okay? I'm not an alcoholic. I drink every day. If I don't drink in the morning, I got a good job, house on the lake, guest house, 2 cars in the garage. You know, when Bill writes about they had to up the ante, that you didn't have to go as low as everybody else did, he was talking about me. Because when that happened, my then wife and I agreed to get a divorce, because I wasn't going to quit drinking. And she went to my parents, my dad and my stepmom. And my stepmom had worked for the Hillsborough County court system for like 25 years. And I never asked her what she did when she retired. She'd been married to my dad about 4 years. And she was the lady who the judges sent DUI or DWI drivers to, and she interviewed them, and she would send them to AA to get their paper signed. Now, I want you to know, up to that point, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd heard of alcoholics. You all wore trench coats. You didn't bathe. You were homeless. You lived under the bridge. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. I really did. And my stepmom looked at me and said, "You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and your wife needs to go to Al-Anon." And she said, "I don't have a problem." And I said, "I'm not an alcoholic. I'm different." A friend of mine got tough love out of his house. His parents told him, "Don't come home anymore if you're drunk." He got drunk and parked his car on the side of a back road in Volusia County and set it on fire and committed suicide. He had burned himself to death. And I went to his funeral, and I know today again the hand of God was there. And at that funeral, something came over me. You know, my life's spinning out of control, totally unmanageable. I'm being told that I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, where a bunch of drunks go and hang out, I think. And the hand of God just came over me and said, "Go to one meeting. Go to one meeting and tell those alcoholics all your great wisdom. Tell them that if they don't quit drinking, they're going to kill themselves." So I called a friend who I knew. He was renting a building for me, and he was running a recovery center, and I knew that he had told me one time that he didn't drink, and I called him and said, "I need to go to one AA meeting. Can you tell me where they are?" And he said, "Yeah, right across the street from your office building. They've been waiting on you for a long time." Now, I'd driven by this building every morning going to work thinking, what a strange place to put a labor pool, right in the middle of downtown Orlando on the major boulevard. And what I come to find out is all those people I saw sitting outside smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, had just come out of a meeting, and it was an AA meeting. And the Central Orlando group is celebrating 70 years next year. It was the first group in Central Florida, the third group in the state of Florida. There's 129 groups in Central Florida right now. So there must have been a lot of resentments and coffee pots going around since 70 years. But we have almost 500 meetings a week in Central Florida. So when my guys that I work with, and I work with a lot of young guys and a lot of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, tell me I can't get to a meeting, I tell them they're full of crap because there's just so many. I went to meetings, and the first meeting I walked in, I told about my friend. They called on me. They must have thought I had something important to say. And I burst out in tears. I said, if you drunks don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And I got up and left. And there was a guy who followed me out. And he said, hey, look, just try not to drink today and come back tomorrow. You know, I didn't know there was people in there with 35 years sobriety when I said that. And I wasn't coming back tomorrow. And at noon the next day, I got up out of my office. I walked across the street. I walked in that meeting. They must have thought I had something to say because they called on me again and burst out in tears, and I said, I can't quit drinking. And I became an alcoholic because I'd never tried to stop drinking before. Never tried at all. And during this period of time, the wife stopped the divorce proceedings because I stopped drinking after 27 days of doing the same thing over and over, walking in crying, I can't quit drinking. I'm sure I heard all the right things. The only thing I remember is keep coming back, you know, and I did. And finally, on a Friday, there was a older gentleman in there, a Jewish man who I loved dearly, passed away with 35 years, I think, named Leo, and he came up to me after the meeting and he said, why don't you go home and drink a bottle of arsenic and kill yourself? Because I'm tired of watching you kill yourself slowly. And that old man didn't know me, and I didn't know him. And I got so mad at him, I went home, and for the first time in over 30 years, I didn't take a drink, and I didn't do a drug. And I went back the next day, and I picked up a white chip. And that old man had survived 5 years in the concentration camps. He had buried and cleaned out all the gas chambers. And if anybody ever had a right to be an alcoholic, it was Leo. And like I said, he had over 30 years at the time. And when I picked up a white chip, I started my recovery on a resentment. Now, I don't know about you, but I know today that if you start your recovery on a resentment, you're not going to stay in recovery. And for the next 3.5 years, I would get time without alcohol and then decide that I'd overshot the illness thing, and I wasn't really an alcoholic. I was different. I could take a drink. And I had never taken one drink in my entire life. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, so that means I drank until my body shut itself down. And that's what a blackout or a passout is your body telling yourself, you got to stop or you're going to die. I had put together by simply white-knuckle prayer, going to meetings, 9 months. 9 months without a drink. And people would ask me, you know, have you got a sponsor yet, Jim? Yes, I do. Who is it? Oh, he doesn't want me to tell you his name. What step are you on? I'm on that fourth step. That's a hard step, that fourth step. I mean, I'm just writing and writing and writing. I don't know if you get it or not. I was sponsoring myself. And a sick man sponsoring a sick man, nobody's getting well. So I put together 9 months. A friend of mine called me and said, why don't we go to a speaker meeting? And I said, sure, let's do that. So we had this guy speaking at my home group, and I went to listen to him, and the guy got up there and told my life story. From what I drank to what I did, he was up there. He had about 9 years sobriety at the time. He was just telling my story, and I was like that bobble-headed doll in the back of the car. I was just nodding and nodding. And the guy who brought me after the end of the meeting said, why don't you go up and shake Joe's hand and tell him thanks? I said, there's a bunch of people around him talking to him and everything. I don't want to interrupt them. And this guy, you know, is like Moses parting the water. He goes up and he moves everybody out of the way. And he goes, Jim, this is Joe, this is my friend Jim. He needs a sponsor. Oh, man. Yeah, he set me up. And I asked Joe, would he sponsor me? And he said, are you done drinking? And I said, yeah, I haven't had a drink in 8 or 9 months. I'm done, I'm pretty sure. And so I took out my business card, and on the white side on the back, I wrote down my phone number. I handed it to Joe, and I said, call me Monday if you want to sponsor me. He took out his business card on the white side. He wrote down his phone number, and he told me, call me Monday if you want me to sponsor you. Now, we turned those two business cards over, and we worked for the same real estate company in two different divisions. We had never met. And I knew right then, the hand of God was there. I went to a 10 o'clock meeting the next morning. Everything was great. I was going to have a sponsor, start working on the steps, start Monday. And my car turned into an ABC liquor store, and I bought a half gallon of whiskey. Because I said to myself, I'm going to have one drink and prove I can do this. I'm going to have one drink. I bought a half gallon of whiskey because I'm going to have one drink. Some people call that alcoholic. I just thought that maybe in a couple of years I might want another drink, and I might as well have the economy size around, you know? So that night I poured one drink, and I don't remember anything else that happened. And I came to the next morning on my kitchen floor, and I was covered in puke, I was covered in blood, and I didn't know who had hurt, because I was a real regular drunk driver, and I thought I'd killed somebody. And it took me about 15 minutes to realize that I had drank half that half gallon, and as I passed out, I hit my head going down on the kitchen table, and I could have bled to death right there. And I called Joe. Now, I can tell you, I've called Joe hundreds of times, and he doesn't answer his phone, goes to voicemail. But that one morning, I called him, and he answered his phone. And he said, you're ready, because he could hear the desperation in my voice. So he said, meet me at your noon meeting, pick up a white chip. Jeez, I just picked up a 9-month chip on Saturday. You want me to pick up a white chip on Monday? Yes. Yes. And then I'll meet you, and we'll start working the steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's exactly what we did. And my life has been forever changed. Beyond a doubt, I'm an alcoholic, powerless over alcohol. My life run by me, even today, is unmanageable. I've got to have God run in my life. I have to surrender in that third step every morning. My will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to a power greater than myself that I came to find in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you said, pick your own conception of God. That's what the book tells me, to pick my own, and I did. And it's a loving, caring God, not a fearful fire and brimstone, what I've heard other people say. I see where religious people are right. I don't condemn wholesale religion just because somebody says something out of line. I try to not have the judgment that I used to have when I first came in here. I wrote out my 4-step for the first time. I'd never done it before, even though I said I had. And there were things that I said to myself, I am not telling Joe. I'm not telling anybody. These are going to my grave. And so Joe gave me 1 week. We're real big in my group on getting through the steps and starting to carry that message. You know, Bob used to get people sober. He used to do the steps with them in 2 days. And we get through them pretty quick out of my group. And when I got to the 5th step, I sat down fully knowing that there were things not written down on my list. Joe told me some of his 5th step. And then he looked right at me and said, now before we get to your list, tell me the things you're going to take to your grave. And they just came out. And I realized how freeing that was for me. That I didn't have to carry that baggage anymore. That I was free of all those secrets. That was keeping me sick. 6 and 7 are prayers to me. And he had me getting right into 8, right in an amends list. And I'm really glad that I had a sponsor. Because I had people on that amends list that I really felt I needed to make amends to, and I was told, leave that person alone. Do not ever go contact that person again. And I didn't. And I made the amends to the best of my ability. And today I don't have to make amends. As much as I did then. I have a 10th step that tells me I still do things kind of screwed up, and I still need to make amends, and I need to do them promptly. I need to do them right then, you know, or as quickly as I can. And I said something stupid down in Eufaula not too long ago, and bam, for 2 days it just ate me. Ate me up. And I went back over there, and I found the person I said it to, and I said, you know, it probably didn't bother you at all, but this bothered me, and I really want to apologize for what I said. I didn't mean it. And the little girl looked at me and said, yeah, we were doing just fine without you before you got here. And we can do just fine without you when you leave. I'm like, ooh, we need to talk to your sponsor. I didn't tell her that, though. In 2006, I'd been coming to Randolph County, Georgia, for about 20 years, hunting. And in 2006, I started looking for... when I was sober 7 days, my dad died. My brother and I inherited the house that we lived in. And in 2006, I started looking for 1 or 2 acres in Randolph County, Georgia, that I could buy and just put a little cabin or trailer on, and I wouldn't have to be camping out all the time. And my older brother, who's retiring from 30 years of teaching calculus, said, I'll go up there with you. And we wound up finding 46 acres adjacent to about a 25,000-acre deer farm with no fences. And you talk about being in heaven, I was in heaven. And my brother built a house. I put a mobile home up there. We built a barn. I opened a real estate company. I incorporated. I bought signs. I had cards printed. I could see all these Floridians coming up there hunting every year. And I knew that I could make a good living opening a real estate company. And I want you to know, it was the day the real estate market died. Sometimes I need to wait a little bit, you know? But that's what happened. And I was up there trying to sell real estate, and I got a phone call from somebody down in Orlando. And she said, your little brother, 10 years younger than me, is in a coma. And my little brother, I tough loved him out of the family after his 5th DUI felony. I just told him that, you know, either he's going to get help or I wasn't going to have anything to do with him. And right before he went into the coma, he told this person, you know, my sister's somewhere, but don't call my brother Jim. Well, my sister was in Hawaii at the time, and so this person called me. And I said, I'll be right there. And she said, I'm a friend of Bill W's. And I've heard you speak. And I knew right then, I had somebody watching over my brother. A couple days later, I went down to Orlando. I took my brother to his radiations. He had 10 tumors as a direct result of alcoholism. And he hadn't had a drink in over a year, because when he got his last felony, they put a monitoring bracelet on his ankle. And it wasn't a GPS monitoring bracelet. It monitors your sweat glands. And if he drank alcohol during his probation, he'd go up to prison for 5 years. And we made a bucket list, because they gave him 6 months to 2 years to live. And I took him to his probation officer with all the doctor and medical reports, and I said, you know, let him go. And they said, okay. So they cut the bracelet off. They dropped all his probation requirements. I said, we're going to do, you know, whatever we can. I'm not jumping out of that airplane. You can jump out of the airplane, but I'm not doing it. If that airplane's moving, I don't have a reason to jump out of it. But I'll film you. We had all these things we were going to do. And after we left the probation department, I said, let's swing by Central, go to a meeting. And he lasted about halfway through the meeting. And he said, I'm really hungry. And I said, okay. So we stopped to get something to eat. And he ordered a glass of wine. And I said, you know, this is not a good decision. You know, this is not a good decision. But I can't run your life. And on the way home from the restaurant, he wanted me to stop, and he bought a gallon of wine. And I just told him, you know, we're not going to get to do all. You can live 2 years. You start drinking like you did before. Alcoholics Anonymous program that has taught me about the progression of this illness is you're going to be right back where you were when you were arrested. And you can't afford that the way you are right now. And I came back up to Georgia. He was going to take about 3 weeks to heal from that radiation, and we were going to start doing things. And in 3 weeks' time, I got a phone call from that girl who said, "Your brother's in intensive care." And so I got in the car and I started driving down. He had blown an ulcer, drinking heavily. And on the way down, I started getting medical reports called into me. He had a DNR. He didn't want to be on a respirator. And so they put him on a respirator anyway, because when he admitted, they didn't have any paperwork on him, so they automatically put him on a respirator. And all the way down to Florida, I was getting reports every hour or so from this person. And I got to about Gainesville, and it was sounding really bad. And she said, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Go get a priest, put the phone on his chest, and have his last rites read." And she did. I got there at 11 o'clock, and I was a little bit upset that he was on a ventilator. And the nurse said, "Well, that's the way he came up to intensive care from downstairs. You're going to have to talk to the administrators tomorrow." And I said, "Okay, but not if God's listening." Because my brother was bloated. He was cold. It was ugly. It was horrible. And at 2 o'clock that morning, his heart stopped. I moved back to Orlando and got really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a real believer in service work. And things went along pretty well until I went into bankruptcy. That wasn't too hot. I got a smart idea that I wanted to be an over-the-road trucker. And the one thing I got in the chain gang was a GED. You know, I never graduated high school, never got that, but I got a legal GED. And the hand of God was there too, because 70 or below is failing, and my highest score was a 66. How do I have a legal GED, you know? How can I be, you know, in real estate when I got a GED, you know? Because I took the course, and God took the test. When I got sober, my son challenged me to become an emergency medical technician. And I said, "Man, I got an 8th grade education, GED, are you kidding me?" And I went there. And I told the paramedic instructors, "You know, I'm probably not going to do anything with this. I just do a lot of traveling, and my son asked me to come here. And it's the most advanced medical thing you can do, because you got to take 3 courses at the same time, and you got to pass all of them by an 80. And I said, "I'll come to class every day, but I'm not going to pass this thing." And the paramedic looked at me and said, "Well, just take it one day at a time." I'd never seen him in a meeting, but I'm telling you, that just, I took it one day at a time. I took the course, God took the test, and I graduated with 2 B's and an A. I don't know how to change the oil in my car, and I want to be an 18-wheel over-the-road trucker. Okay, Alcologic, here we go. So I go to school down in Florida, and I train, and I take the course, God takes the test, I become an 18-wheel CDL Class A driver, and of course the Moors kick back in, and, you know, what's the highest you can do in over-the-road trucking? Well, that's hazmat. Well, let me take that test. And so I did, and God passed that test. And Homeland Security had to investigate me before I could go out. And I'm clean with Homeland Security. I'm clean with the FBI. I'm one of the first people in Georgia to have a drug conviction and actually have a concealed weapon permit. The judge said they've never issued one before, and I have one now. Because of where I live, I kind of need one. And I joined the volunteer firefighter up there and EMT. And I was going back and forth. I started going over the road trucking. I trained in Florida. My first job started in Chattanooga, Tennessee. There are mountains in every state except for Florida. And I'm pulling hazmat load, trying not to grind gears going up the hill and trying not to crash going down the hill. And within 6 weeks, I passed 6 kidney stones in the back of an 18-wheel truck. And I know pain. I'm well aware of pain. After the 6th one, I got off the truck, I went to my doctor, and he says, "You're not a truck driver." And I'm not. I got back into real estate, and then how I wound up in Randolph County again is last November, a friend of mine's brother, who had a leg amputated from diabetes directly due to alcoholism, called and said, "Can I go up to your property with you? I want to talk to you about my brother. He's going to be released from rehab here." And so as we're driving up, I told him, I'm not playing God, but I've seen this happen over and over. I know your brother. He's going to get out. He's going to have a pocket full of pain pills. He's going to want to buy his gallon of wine right away. In about a couple weeks, you're going to find him dead. What happened was he died 2 days later. But when we got to the property in Georgia, I found my older brother dead. He had been dead 3 days from untreated alcoholism. And last April was the first time I could go back to the property and say to myself, okay, God, you want me up here, sell the property because I can't keep it and go to Orlando, and I'll carry the message. Now, at first I told God, property in your hands, you sell it, and I'll go back to Orlando. And then I realized I was speaking somewhere, Dothan, Abbeville, somewhere, and I realized I had not surrendered 100%. I was still telling God where I was going to go when he sells the property. And so I had to go the next day, and I had to get on my knees and say, God, wherever you want me to be, that's where I want to be today. Wherever you want me to go, that's where I want to go. And it would be Phenix City, Alabama this morning. It'll be Eufaula this evening because we'll have a speaker meeting down there. And a couple of things, you know, this program has absolutely changed my life. Changed the way I think, changed the way I act. And it's just today. It's just today. I only have today. Nothing in this book and nothing in any other book I read tells me that if I do a great job today, I'm going to wake up tomorrow. Nothing's promised. All that's promised is if I do God's work well, I'll have a great life. And carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is doing God's work well, I think. I carry around a member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous, a little free pamphlet that we give out at a lot of places. And I carry it around because here lately I've started really liking a couple things in here. One, the guy writing this thing talks about people who come to AA and they go to AA meetings and they don't do anything else and they're hoping something's going to rub off on them. And it does. It's called rigor mortis, dying from untreated alcoholism. If you don't do something when you get here, if you don't implement these spiritual principles in your life, you're just going to die miserable. You know, who wants to die miserable? Might as well be drunk. And then at the end of the pamphlet, and I'm still not, you know, not the real church core, but this thing talks about, you know, when John the Baptist was in prison, and he sent two of his friends to talk to this guy they thought might be the Messiah, his cousin, the carpenter. And they asked him, is he the Messiah? And he said, just go back to John and tell him what you've seen and what you've heard. That the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, and the sick do get well. And I know today, you know, almost 12 years later, I know today that that's exactly what I would tell people about Alcoholics Anonymous. That what I've seen and heard is the blind do see, the deaf do hear, the lame do walk. And the sick in spirit do get well. Because through the longest day and the darkest night, when the good news is carried to them, alcoholics recover. Alcoholics recover. And I always end with the foreword to the third edition, which is the book I came in on. The last part of that, it says, every day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I hope I've done that this morning. Thank you.